and welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 661. I'm one of your hosts, Sky Vercoy, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, dude?
It's crazy. Not sure how I feel about the weekend. There was great joy and excitement. My daughter graduated from high school.
Nice.
There's been sort of that whole thing that kind of doesn't really depress me, but it's Memorial Day weekend in the U.S., which is the holiday where we honor all the veterans and those who served and those who died in the line of service for the country. So that is kind of sad, but it's like the necessary history thing. And then there was Mugello, which is really great racing at a really great track, but had really bad things that happened to it too. Mm-hmm. So there's so much there that I'm twisted and don't know what really to think about the weekend, to be honest with you.
Yeah, we had a great Indy 500 race as well.
Yes, four-time winner. That was impressive.
Yeah, and just
that's an elite club. That's a very elite club.
And going down to the wire, and just that was an all-around great race. If you're a four-wheel fan, make sure you get it. Check that one out. But yeah, it's you know, I was talking to you a little bit before the show. You know, outside of the MotoPod, I've been having lots of fun at work with the upper management, and yeah, things are not going. We're getting a little battle over there, so we'll see how that plays out in the next month or so. And then, speaking of work, I've gone back to work, so that's one thing, right? Off paternity leave now. Little guy's over at daycare, so that was a little tough to get used to at first, and like, you know, not seeing him all
tough
day long. Yeah, but yeah, we had a great weekend of racing, and you know, Jim, before we get started with the show, since we're coming off of a mixed emotions, let's just settle it all down with a nice beer.
There you go.
What's
on it, Chris?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I've gone back to something I've known. I'm not being very adventurous lately because my beer drinking is limited. I try to drink, you know, I have one for the show, but on the weekends, I was one of those guys. I was like Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, go. And now I've restricted myself to one night because, yeah, you keep drinking beer, you kind of get fat. So I've been cycling more and drinking less, and it's good for my health.
That's good. That's good.
All right.
So, how's that one taste?
This is good. This is one I've had before from Almanac. This is their loud, hazy double IPA. Now, since it's a double IPA, this is probably going to get me slightly loose by the end of the show. I think it's appropriately named loud. It's an 8%er, so it's got some strength to it.
Yeah, you're going to be like the Acosta of this podcast because the back end's always loose on that bike.
Way to bring it around for the show. All right, perfect.
Somebody has to.
Exactly. Now, before we do get back or over to our listener feedback, I just want to mention, Richard, we did get your email. We're in discussions, and we will get back to you probably later on this week. Folks, just remember from our last show, we have put out a call to those of you that may be interested in hosting the show. I am going to be stepping away from the show after this season. This is my last season on the show. I'm not going to do the little hiatus like I did before. I'm actually going to be stepping back indefinitely. And Jim wants to keep the lights on here. He wants to keep the show going, and he needs a partner to do that. So if you're interested, you want to get on here and babble up motorcycle racing, remember, you don't need to be a former mechanic. You don't need to be a former racer. You don't need to be a former team owner or anything like that. You just got to have a passion for motorcycle racing, motorcycles, and you want to talk about it for endlessly on hours and hours and maybe do some editing here and there. If that sounds like right up your alley, just shoot us an email at motopod@motopodcast.com. We'll go ahead. We'll reach out to you. We'll talk about it. We'll see what your interest is, what you want to do. We'll test you out on some shows and see how it goes. All right, folks. And with that, Jim, why don't you take us into the first listener feedback we've had this week?
So the first thing in listener feedback, I want to have a shout out to MadCow9, who put out a review on iTunes for us. I just saw it there. It said it had been posted back in April of 2021. I just now saw it on there. Nice review. Appreciate it very much. It helps us get the rating. More people will see us. We'll be in the searches. We'll be higher up. So again, thank you for that. And if you guys can, if you like this show, write a review, put it on iTunes. Again, all we want to do is reach more people and let them be able to enjoy motorcycling the way that we enjoy motorcycling. So please do that if you can. the first bit of listener feedback that we actually have is from Sean. Sean says, do you know what's wrong with Moto3 qualifying? No, I really don't know. Please tell me. that it even exists, is what he says. Then. There's no need for it. The thing that matters the most in the race isn't who, or the thing that matters the most in the race isn't who's fastest. It's who's still in the draft. The fastest guy in qualifying will get beat if someone is in the draft. And the fastest guy in the field can't get away from the draft. You can't blame any rider for trying to take advantage of that. He'd be dumb not to. If you really want to see who's fast, then let them do single rider, single lap qualifying like in Moto E, or just grid them by points. So I did write back to Sean on this one. Number one, I have no desire to see Moto 3 qualifying in a single lap format.
There's
that are going to be there. At 90 seconds a lap, that's like 45 minutes of paint drying for me. No, did that in Formula One. That sucked. Not going to go do it again.
I just remember Super Pole in general from everything, from like watching an AMA, World Superbike, Super Pole, folks. It's been a while since we've been there. We've been over a decade. And yeah, if memory serves you, short, it is extremely boring.
Mm-hmm. It's no matter how you put it, if it's single lap, there is no excitement that's going to happen in it at all. I mean, you can try to build up that excitement because, oh, this guy's fast in the first sector. He's always down by a tenth in the second sector. He's got to make that up. But it's not like what you have when there's 20 guys going for it at the very end. Now, his idea was single lap qualifying. Nope, don't want it. Not at all. No, thank you. Grid them by points. Now, that's an interesting concept.
It really is.
Grid the field. It's interesting. I like that part of it. Of all of this, I like the idea that, okay, we're going to put them in their order based on the points that they had. Okay. My question then becomes, how do you settle the very first race of the year? Because if your world champion moves on, what do you do? Just whoever was second in the championship who happens to still be in the classes there, he's now the first guy on the grid. That's possible. I'm not going to deny that that's a way to do it.
Team points from the previous year?
Team points from previous year. That is always a way to start it out, right?
Or Rochambeau.
Rochambeau. I would watch that on MotoGP.com. If you had Rochambeau for the pole position for Moto3, I would watch it. Don't ask me why. I would. Seriously. So those are all good ideas. I think that, number one, you can't grid them by points. And the reason I say that is because these guys need to be able to learn how to practice, to take in the pressure of qualifying, to figure out how to get the best out of themselves and their motorcycle when they are out there. That's what you learn to do when you're qualifying in Moto 3 and Moto 2, so that when you get to MotoGP, you can get the best out of the soft tire that you're going to have on the bike and do it. If you don't let them qualify and they only practice, they're never going to be in that simulation and they're never going to know exactly what to expect of themselves, the bike, track, other people on the track, etc. However, I agree that I agree with you 100%, Sean, that like it doesn't really matter where you qualify. I think, Skylar, you've been on that horse, beating that dead horse for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on it. If you're in the first five rows of a MotoGP race and you're in the top 10 in that lead draft, at some point you have a chance to win that race. So
I mean, Jim, not even top five. These guys have won from the pit lane start. We've seen it this year.
Yes. On a track that was very conducive to being able to do that.
Yes, yes.
But that's a whole different story.
You're not doing it at the Shasher Ring. You're not going to do it there. No.
But there has to be something done. I don't want to see any more dawdling. I hate the penalties that keep getting put out, etc. Everything that's been tried hasn't really worked. My personal solution is that we run qualifying with a percentage of lap time. So we have to give them a base time. You have to maintain this time to be able to be considered to be able to qualify. So it's kind of like, the only way I can explain is to use a Formula One analogy. If you watch Formula One, they have a virtual safety car where they give the drivers a delta time on their screen saying, hey, you need to be, back across the line at somewhere between 1:40 and 1:45. So that's what you're trying to shoot for. Now that's going to keep everybody from dawdling. They might dawdle at the beginning, but they're going to have to make time to get there, to get into their window, or they miss it. And if they miss it, well, then you're done with qualifying. It's just simple as that. Like, hey, you didn't make it into your window. You got to go. I think that's a way to do it. I don't know how you would exactly control it, but it's something that I think should be tried or at least discussed in principle. And then you could kind of simulate it in like the free practice 3 for the Moto 3 bikes, just to see kind of how it would work, and you can work on it from there. You got any other suggestions, Skylar, that we could use to fix qualifying for Moto 3?
I mean, I think we both talked about the getting out there and you have to run the delta time, right? There's no dawdling around. It's a racetrack. Get out there and race. There's no sitting off to the side. And that's just for safety reasons in general. You don't want someone who's going, 60 miles per hour slower than somebody else while looking over their back and get ran into. That's just, it's not going to go well. But other than that, maybe increase the penalties. You do it like two times and you're out of the next race or something. I don't know. But it's definitely a problem we have to fix. But I don't see it being corrected anytime soon because it's been a problem for a long time. They barely started doing anything about it.
Yeah, it's going to take time. The penalties are going to have to become so severe that they are not going to be used, be useful. Like, oh, well, okay, your fastest lap was taken away. Well, you start saying you're not racing next race. Okay. Hey, you were dawdling. You're not starting. Your fastest lap time isn't scrubbed. You're starting from the back row. Maybe that'll get there. They're going to have to progressively inch towards a solution. We can armchair this all day long, but I think we should go on to Keith's question and the feedback if you don't have anything else.
No, hop on over to Keith, and thanks, Sean, for writing in.
All right, so Keith Kovac writes in. He says, hi, guys. Have a question for you in regards to Mark. Can Mark's results be more of a development issue with the bike rather than a physical one? In the race at Le Mans, we saw a glimpse that he still has that feel in wet conditions, but in the dry, it seems he is missing just that edge to get to the top. To me, he is trying to manhandle the bike to do his will, but if it's not doing quite what he wants, do you think that by the end of the season he will be more on form, or is the season being a wash for him? Also, shout out to the two American riders in the top 10 this week. Way to carry the flag for us. Keith, thanks for writing in. This is a very loaded question. First and foremost, you're kind of there with the motorcycle. We know Nakagami, we know that the Honda is not the best handling motorcycle on the track.
Correct.
That's a given. Marquez's magic is the fact that he could bend that motorcycle to his will, which he cannot do right now because he does not have the proper feeling and strength in the arm that he busted. Now, we did find out in sort of a roundabout way, and this is all courtesy of Damon Emmett's Twitter feed, that Mark actually had nerve damage at the top of the shoulder caused from when he – the way I took it in the tweets when I read it was that that was a problem from the surgery he had to correct when his shoulder would pop out all the time. So he had, it wasn't necessarily that the nerve damage was happened when he broke his humerus. If he's got feeling or tingling or something in the shoulder that's going to migrate to his arm, he's not going to be able to ride at the level that Mark Marquez can ride at until he can fix that or overcome that. Now, again, the bike is not that good. We know Nakagami went back to the 2019 frame. I believe that Honda has a 2021 frame because engine development wasn't really allowed. And I think they were allowed, they froze it because of the pandemic, but I do think they were able to, let's say, make updates. So maybe it's a 2020.1 frame with maybe some bits or pieces that have been put on or added to or subtracted from within some realm of reason. It's definitely not a bike that is good enough to be at the front with an average Mark Marquez. A brilliant Mark Marquez, i.e. Mark Marquez prior to the breaking of the humerus bone, was making that 2020 bike look brilliant in Jerez up to that point. I mean, anybody who comes from literally dead last in the gravel trap to basically third place in, what do you do it in, Skylar, 18-ish laps, roughly,
like that,
is pretty amazing. So it's a two-folded thing. I talked to the official doctor at Motopod, and she said clearly, hey, the bones are now healed. We are roughly in 6 months past his surgery date. His surgery was the end of November, first part of December. 6 months on, he's now to the point where the bones healed, and it's as strong technically as the bone's going to be. However, he doesn't have the muscle strength that's there, and it's going to take him a while to do it. I don't care what kind of training he's doing in the gym, what kind of weights he's lifting, and what process he's doing it in. There is nothing that you have in the gym that is going to simulate the 1.7 Gs of braking force that has to be brought through his wrist, his shoulder, his elbow to get there. He's going to get better the more that he rides that motorcycle. The doctor has said it's the best thing for him to do is to ride the motorcycle. Yep, he can ride, and he's doing well. What we really want to look at here is what's going to happen when they get to the Saxon Ring. That's important because that track is going to the left. He's not going to have as much pressure on his right side or his right shoulder. So I'm interested to see what happens there because that's, you know, the anti-clockwise circuits are the ones that we want to look at. So Saxon Ring, Aragon, doubtful we're going to Texas. I know that one off the top of my head is anti-clockwise. So basically, I think it's a twofold, right? Mark could probably get to, over the injuries, be near the podium or on the podium at dry races at the end of the season, probably consistently or being right there. I think the 2022 Marquez is the one that has the greatest potential for actually winning again and showing us what he has. Skyler, thoughts?
There's not too much to add to that. If I did see somewhere, I think he still has some issues with his triceps as well. That's kind of like, you know, the top where they were doing the surgery. He's got to recover the atrophy that he experienced there. It looked like he might have been still using a brace while he was riding. So he definitely still has like a limitation of his mobility altogether in that arm. And until he gets that sorted out, it's not going to be the Mark Marquez that we're used to and getting to the front, especially riding the way that he wants to ride on a bike that is definitely not he always made the bike look better than it actually is, right? Yeah. And this year's bike is, I mean, you can see it from the other guys that are riding the bike. Pole is no slouch. We've seen, you know, Takagami get a pole position with it and be on the podium several times last year, and he's nowhere to be found on this bike. So this bike is definitely not where it needs to be. So, and the short answer, Keith, little column A, little column B.
Yeah, agreed. So thanks for writing in, Keith. Appreciate it very much. I think we shall move on to the news.
That's right, folks. Remember, just before we get out onto the news, if you want to write in, just like Keith and Sean did, that we can be found at Motopod at motopodcast.com. It goes to all of the hosts. If we find it's a good conversation starter, we'll just put it on the show. Otherwise, we'll just answer you or one of the other hosts to answer you. Or you may get lucky and get one of the other hosts that have been on the show before. Maybe you'll get Lynn, Jules, or maybe Dave might pop in, or Martin, or, you know, or Andrew. You never know. We just send it in. You'll get someone to talk about it. All right, Jim, let's get on over to the news.
Well, the worst part of the news is the fact that we have the sad part. And that's the tragedy of Jason Dupasquier having succumbed to the injuries he sustained in a Moto3 crash in qualifying. I thought about this for a long time about how I wanted to think about this and present this to you guys. I was watching qualifying live. It's, like I said, it was Memorial Day weekend here. I went into instant shock because it was one of those things like, what happened? I instantly wound it back because I wanted to know what happened. And it was abundantly clear that this was the same kind of accident that we've seen with Tomizawa, with Simoncelli. It's that, hey, somebody's coming. It's a blind hill, and they couldn't possibly avoid him. Now, I do not know 100% for sure if Sasaki actually did hit him or just hit his bike. And quite honestly, I don't care. I don't want to know in any way, shape, or form, because the long story short of this is that somebody with immense talent had their life cut short by a racing accident. And that's what it was, folks. It was a racing accident. You can't be around this sport as long as I have and not see death. What's disturbing to me is the fact, and this is from Matt Oxley in his great article in MotoGP, is that we are on a one death per every 2.5 years of MotoGP. That is alarming to me. Now, I don't have any answers for how you take close racing like Moto3 and make it safer. But something needs to be looked at. This is the third type of accident that it has been the following motorcycle that is the villain of this crime scene. And I'm sorry, crime scene is not what I want to use. That's wrong, because it's not a crime scene. Okay, I'm not putting blame on anybody at this. It's something that just happened, but I don't know how to fix it. I wish I did, but I have no way. And I'm not sure that anybody really has any idea of really how to fix it, despite the advancements of airbags and suits, great helmets, leather, all that stuff. There's still that element of chance. And I will tell you, from a racing perspective, it's that on the edge living that draws you to what is being done on that motorcycle. It's the reason I raced bikes, because that idea, not so much that I'm cheating death, but that I am in that moment living life to its incredible fullest, is what drove me to do it. That thrill, that edge, that feel, that wherever it is that you're controlling something that isn't controllable, that drives you. It drives every one of these guys on that grid. I don't care who it is. It's what drives them. And unfortunately, sometimes you are not able to do that. And it is with the greatest sympathy and heavy heart that I pray for everybody in the paddock, for DePasquier's family, his parents. They're going through something tremendously terrible. And I wish them all the best. And all I can say is, race in peace, Jason.
No, I think that was well put, Jim. Definitely is a tragedy that we do lose Jason so young, and we have to see these things. The sport that we love is definitely a cruel, cruel one, and sometimes we have to deal with these things. But as Jason would want, and as all we want, the show must go on. All right, so on to the more positive news of things here. Is Brad Binder has a new contract until 2024. I think this is pretty much in the bag. I mean, KTM be foolish not to re-sign him, and I think he's got a good home there for his skill set.
Yep, I agree. We know that Gresini MotoGP team with the Aprilia is seriously considering an offer from Ducati. Ducati wants a lot of bikes on the grid, so they are seriously considering an offer. I do not know if this is, well, we'll take it if you guys, if Rossi's team backs out of the deal. I'm not sure if one is contingent on the other, but somewhere somebody's got to make a decision, and they got to make it quick, because if Aprilia really is going to have a factory team and a satellite team, they need to know quickly, because they need to know how many bikes they're going to have to build, or somebody's going to be riding last year's bikes. So that is a stay tuned moment for sure. Along with that, Ducati is enamored with the VR46 talent pool, and they want to supply what would be the Aramco VR46 MotoGP bikes with Ducatis. Why not? Rossi's found some great talent. Wouldn't you want Italian talent on an Italian motorcycle? Oh, whoa, wait a minute. We tried that, didn't we? Because we had the greatest racer of all time probably on the bike, didn't we? Yeah, that didn't work out very well, did it?
Not so much.
Yeah, okay, well, no, but either way, Ducati wants to have that team. I think they want to be associated again with that brand. Mm-hmm. And that's their driving motivation for that one. So again, we're supposed to know something here shortly. I figure we're going to know something before Barcelona. That's my guess. That's kind of like, I think where we get to this, Ducati needs to know how many bikes they're going to make.
In that case, Jim, it'll be out tomorrow. That's what'll happen.
Right. Because it'll be, yeah, it might hit. Yeah. It's probably going to hit here this late tonight in the United States for me. Yeah. I'll wake up and my phone will be like, hey, guess what? Information I could have used 8-10 hours ago.
That's right.
Oh, let's see. Where are we? Oh, rumors are swirling that both Raul Fernandez and Remy Gardner are moving to MotoGP. If so, with what team? Is it Tech 3? Is it likely that Lecuona and Petrucci are gone? Okay, before we go any farther, think about that for a second, Skylar. Tell me what you think.
I mean, I kind of been seeing this. It's that Lecuona and Petrucci were both placeholders. Lecuona, he was given his chance, right, to see what he could do. He's had some promising results, but he definitely crashed his brains out there for a little while. And he's a guy that could do with some more developing, maybe at the Moto 2. And Petrucci, I mean, he's just been kind of scaling back on his way out. He kind of picked up this ride. It was like, okay, what's left out there? We get this guy, and we'll see what comes up next year. And I think they're watching, you know, where to see the Moto 2 guys are at. And they've seen so much out of them. They know they can't afford to lose these guys to other teams because they're both right at the front of the field. Yeah. And I just can't see KTM, you know, Tech 3 holding on, because those are factory bikes. They're a plus one team at this point with the factory. They're all working towards the same goal, and you want the best riders, and maybe, you know, the riders are going to give you the best chance, and that's a development team too. You're not developing Petrucci anymore. Now, like, one of those, a case that you're going to develop him, but what you've seen so far is maybe what you get. Right, you haven't seen him make a big leap. You kind of seen him make a small step, and you're looking for a bigger out of your guys.
Well, we're kind of prognosticators, because it just came out this afternoon that Remy Gardner is going to MotoGP.
Well, there you go.
And he is going to Tech 3. There was no mention of what's happening to Lecuona or Petrucci. I assume we're going to know more late tonight, tomorrow. or you know, Thursday's press conference at Barcelona as to what's going on there, but we know that for sure. Now, is there any rule in the MotoGP rule book that says that a team can't field more than two motorcycles?
I don't know that one, actually.
Well, see, this is what got me wondering here. I went down this road thinking this logic. From the standpoint of, we know that Dovizioso forced Honda's hand and made them honor a contract where they raced three factory motorcycles out of the factory garage.
Yeah, but I'll let you finish up. Maybe you're going to get to it.
So what I'm thinking is, okay, does KTM build two more motorcycles? Lecuona, maybe Petrucci parts company, but Lecuona stays. Raul has a bike and Remy has a bike, and they're in Tech 3 colors.
Now, wasn't the whole HRC thing, wasn't that, or the third Honda, an HRC Honda and a Repsol Honda, which would have designated they were technically on another team, even though they came out of the same garage? So that's why I wonder if, like, maybe it is a two bike or two rider limit, and that's how they skirted that.
Man, I could have sworn that bike was... That what bike was a Repsol bike that Dovizioso had.
I mean,
have to go back and look.
But I feel like it was under the HRC banner. Like, this is our HRC bike sponsored by Repsol. Like, you know, that kind
like
of thing.
Like a permanent wild card, kind of.
Yeah.
You might be right about that one. I don't know. Just throwing it out there, because, I mean, I would like to... I don't want to... We don't know. Raul may not be going to Tech 3. It's still, that's a rumor. We don't know anything there. It's one of these moving parts things, and I like to try to figure out where all the chips are going to fall. So I'm just throwing something out there.
I would think, though, if you're taking Remy, you're taking Raul, because if we look at results so far this year, exactly. I mean, yeah.
Because I was trying to figure out, though, Raul's 20 or will be 21 next year.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know, like, you couldn't put Acosta in a MotoGP bike because he wouldn't be 18, right? So he's I'm sure that Raul is 20 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's finish off this news here. So a lot of the MotoGP riders did not want to race after the announcement that happened right before the Moto2 race. And then they had a moment of silence right before the MotoGP race about DePasquier. Chief among them was Benyaya, you know, there was because of others that just said that maybe we shouldn't have raced and whatnot. I don't know how I feel about that one, but it's safe to say that there was not any kind of unity about whether we should or should not be racing. And I'll leave that one to you guys to judge what you think about that. But the last one, let's end on a very happy note with the news. What do you say, Skyler?
Yeah, I'm good with that.
All right, so how about this? And I'm not sure how we missed this. I mean, I know I heard about this a long time ago, but we never said anything about it on the show. But supposedly, a Formula One-esque Drive to Survive series that's been on Netflix for the last three Formula One seasons is being done for MotoGP. It's supposedly going to be on the Amazon Prime deal, so if you have Amazon Prime, you can see this. And the best part about it is that the director of the Faster series of motorcycle films, Mark Neal, is behind the camera yet again to do this one. This one will probably be really good. I don't like the Drive to Survive series. I've tried watching it, and I cannot do it.
Really?
This, yeah, I don't know why. I had so many people tell me it's so good, and I can't do it.
Interesting.
And I literally do not know why. I wish I could put my finger on it, but I hate it. But this, I think it'll be pretty good.
That is interesting. I actually like the series. And I've actually got three new friends of racing now because of that. So
yeah,
maybe that's what this could do for other people. I've been slowly sucking my wife into it. She sits there and she's nice. Like, she'll be like sitting there. She's like, okay. So she's like, we have certain, riders. So I've been talking about Cam and Moto 2. She's like, okay, so Moto 2, that's like the middle one, right? Between MotoGP and Moto 3. I'm like, you're getting this. All right, good. I'm slowly poisoning the well here. And she won't be going to a race anytime. She spent enough time at the track when I was on race teams that I could tell you she's not that interested. But when it comes to the big show, obviously it's more interesting than club racing for sure.
Yeah. All right, that is the news, people. So, once you, I'll go quickly through MotoGP qualifying, and then you tell us about the race. Is that cool?
Sounds good.
All right, so MotoGP qualifying, we had Vinales, Marquez, Nakagami, Bastianini, and Aleix Espargaró all in that first qualifying session. This is the first time Vinales has been in the Q1 session. Skyler, I think you're right. Sometime, some way, everybody's going to spend one time.
That's in Q1 right.
Because the qualifying has been that manic. Vinales and Marquez had did their first runs, and they were sort of balked by a slow Nakagami. Espargaró had knocked, it was following Vinales all around. It didn't matter where Vinales went. Marquez followed him. Like, literally, he followed him into the shortcut of the pits and back through again. And Vinales literally lost his shit over it. Part of me, Simon Crafer said this, and I echo it, so I'm kind of paraphrasing it. He's like, I love the fact that Marquez does this and Vinales loses his shit over it, because that's kind of what's cool about what Mark does to you. But on the other hand, my inner part is like, I really feel for Vinales, because you just want to go down and not tow everybody around. I feel the same way. I get it. It's part of racing, but part of it was like the tenacity Mark showed, like, nope, there's no way I'm going by you. Like, usually somewhere they'll sort it out on that lap and somebody will just wind up being ahead of somebody, but he had the immense patience just to let him be there and fall around. But that was a smart move by Marquez, because that allowed him to set a lap that was fast enough to be on the number one guy going through. Vinales was his number two, except at the very end, Aleix Espargaró threw in a great qualifying run to nip him. So Marquez and Aleix went through to the second qualifying session. Then the second qualifying session, basically this was going to be Quartararo's deal. He had been fast all weekend. He'd been fast in all the practices. By the end of the first session, Quartararo was on top. Aleix was second quick, followed by Miller, Bagnaia, Rins, and Binder. KTM looking relatively good there. But when the cards and the dust all settled from the second run, it was Quartararo followed by Bagnaia, who was the fastest of the Ducatis, followed by Zarco, Aleix Espargaró, which was the best dry qualifying for the Aprilia yet. I'm telling you guys, that Aprilia is real, and I really want to see Dovizioso on that bike. Then Miller was fifth, then Binder, Oliveira. So the KTMs qualified sixth and seventh. They had a new frame, new bits, new parts, new pieces, and apparently they've got some flex figured out in that frame, because supposedly they made some printed parts that they put on the frames that allowed them to get better feel and not use the rear tire, which is great qualifying for them. Then Rins, Mir, Morbidelli, Marquez, and Pol Espargaró to end up qualifying.
All right, so a couple things about this. We lost our bet with when Dovizioso was coming back. I thought this was the round he'd make his appearance, because Salvadori, outside of a bit of a rain performance, really hasn't done much, and I thought for sure. So Dovizioso definitely isn't, when he said he wasn't interested in coming back this year and just doing some testing, I guess he's pretty serious. And it's all kind of gone quiet on that front too. We haven't heard much about that since those initial test runs. For this Vinales, trying to shake Marquez, I don't know how dirty you can get in tactics, but I know a surefire way that always worked when other people that I may or may not have worked with were being, you know, hunted down and they wanted to go out and sit there. They go, they fly around the track and then they wait till one of those corners they'd be going through and then they would just stand it right in the middle of the corner and let off the gas and the person behind them would blow wide and as soon as they blow wide, they'd be back on the gas and they can never catch them after that. And I was like, hey, you know, Maverick, if you want to start pulling some tactics yourself, dude, you got to start just, you know, looking over your shoulder and telling people to go by is not, you got to make them not want to follow you. You better do some sketchy shit where they're like, never mind, never mind.
Fair point.
I mean, just like, you're not going to get rid of them. And plus, let's just be real. I'm pretty sure you have all followed Mark Marquez around once or twice. He's going to do it to you. But I think the complaining is not the way you get around that. You get around that by, it's fire with fire, if you're going to, you know, use some like a metaphor. But it was definitely an interesting Q1 to watch, that's for sure. And then it totally ruined his head for the whole weekend, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, see, that's where I think people need to be more like Casey Stoner. Screw it. I'm going out first. I'm going to lay down a lap that you can't possibly touch. And when you do, I'm going to go back out later and go faster.
Well, the problem is, I love that approach. I think they would love to have that mentality. I just don't know if they have the talent to do it. No, that was a special talent. That's not a slight on anyone in particular. Dude, know, there's not many people that can go out and set the fastest lap of qualifying by the third lap and come back and take your helmet off and sit in the box like, hey, how about it, boys? Go get it. And that was unique.
It's some kind of wonderful is what that is, really, to be honest with you.
Exactly. That was, I mean, watching, I just remember specifically Ben Spies came back in the box. I can't remember what track it was, but Stoner had gone out and he'd done the third lap and he set the fastest lap and Spies did his first run, comes in. You see him look up and he was like top five at the time. He might have been like third or something like that. He looks up at the board and you see him shake his head and you just know he's looking at Stoner like, how in the hell did he run that time?
Yep.
Oh, man. But all right, let's get on to the race. Now, we had an incident before the race even gets started. We're coming back around on the warm-up lap, and Bastianini, I think, personally, decided he didn't want to pay attention to what was going on in front of him because he didn't realize that Zarco was warming up his brakes and was slowing down and ran into the back of him. And here's the thing, though. I would be more on Bastianini's side if he ran onto him, ran into the back of him somewhere else, but they were literally almost at the grid, if not at the grid, and this is what guys do on their brakes all the time. I just don't know what Bastianini was looking at and how he ran into him.
Well, I thought about this for a while, and I'm not inside of Bastianini's head, but are you super focused after what you just learned? No. A lot of people weren't.
I mean, that's the whole visor down thing, though, right? Isn't that the whole thing, these guys? Look, visor down, out, everything else goes quiet.
Exactly. That's how it should be. But, you know, trying to think of how I want to put this. Let's look at this way. The guys who race bikes in the 80s are not the same kind of guys who race the bikes now.
No.
It's a very different mentality, approach, concept. So it's just different. One is not better than the other. Okay. It's just different, and I'm just, you know, everybody has a moment where they do crazy things and things happen. I've seen Formula One cars hit the pace car, hit safety cars, doors, and knock it off. Talking to you, Nick Heidfeld. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so there's always a lapse of concentration that will cause you a problem no matter what. What was really bizarre was he had stoppied that thing so bad that his face smashed the back of the seat of the Ducati.
A endo for sure.
Yo, man, that was just crazy. Yeah, so what a way to start the MotoGP race with Baldassare just and his whole suit is all blown out, so he's trying to run like the Michelin man to get on the other bike.
I will say this for Bastianini, though. At least you did that your rookie year, and people go, rookie mistake. I mean, can you imagine someone like if Vinales did that? Like, dude, how many years you've been doing this? Like, you can't do that. So I guarantee Bastianini, it will never happen again. That's a one and done on that.
You know, it could have been cold carbon brakes too, right?
Because
it can be because they don't work unless they're hot. So if Bastianini saw it, you know, sort of late and didn't really react to what Zarco was doing, and he grabbed it, it's no bite, no bite, no bite, bite! And then he goes over top.
Maybe. Well, anyway, that was the incident before the race. Now we have a race.
We have a race. Yes, go to there.
Technically, it might be the most exciting part of it. But anyway, so we get to the race, and Yamaha has a new hole shot device. Now, Yamaha has been a dog off the line forever. The way that their motor works, it's not conducive for hard launches. But they have a new hole shot device, and Jim, it freaking works, man. Dude, Quartararo got off the line very well, considering he was surrounded right there with the Ducatis. Yeah, that was impressive. He only got beat out by the slightest from Nardis by Nyai, who got into the corner and got to the start of the race. Now, we get around the first lap. You know, we kind of settled in, and we wanted to see how fast is that Ducati going to be down the front straight? And, of course, it's Mugello coming out of the corner, wind up the Ducati. It's like a cheat code at that track. It just blows by everybody gaps, and you're like, okay, if you cannot pass that bike somewhere in the first 4 to 5 corners and build up a small gap, you will not get away from it. So with that in mind, we keep on going. And Marc Marquez ended up crashing it out. Now, this was a little bit of a slider. So he ran into Binder. He was trying to look like he got underneath him. But then on the exit of the corner, he made contact with Binder, and he was a loser of that contact. He went down. Binder got a little wild, but he was able to save that. But as Mark's bike was spinning around, he ended up Morbidelli had to miss it, so he had to take hard action and brake and then run out into the gravel trap, so his race is pretty much ruined. But he did manage to miss the spinning bike of Marc Marquez. And that was on the first lap. We get to the second lap. Pecco Bagnaia is up front. He's looking strong. And just as we get done looking at the crash of Marquez that we caught live on camera, we zip on back. We're watching Pecco come into the turn, and away goes the front end. And he's crashing out there on lap 2 from the lead at the home race with Ducati and himself. Definitely was a big, big bummer for that team. That's for sure. But
that is where I think couple things. One, Binder's airbag deployed, so he ran 2 laps trying to get the airbag to deflate.
Oh, that's never
after
fun.
After that contact with Marquez. Second, this is where Quartararo is on the lucky side of things this year. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's always luck, right? The intangible of luck, right?
Yes.
Is the fact that if Bagnaia isn't out on the curbs and tries to turn in on the curbs, I don't think he loses the front. If Bagnaia doesn't lose the front, I don't think Quartararo can pass him, because I think that Bagnaia and how he rides the Ducati, he would have been able to stay ahead of Quartararo in the twisty bits and just use the cheat code on the main stretch and stay just far enough away that Quartararo couldn't do anything with him. Now, that's all ifs and buts and candy and nuts and whatnot, but I think that Bagnaia was on for at least keeping Quartararo very honest, if nothing else.
No, I think you're right. I think that's where the race was going to be. But he ended up getting in the way, and Quartararo was like, okay, cool, I have an open track, and see you later. And he takes off, and Quartararo definitely has the Lorenzo Yamaha thing figured out. Get to the front, you get to pick your lines, and you just hammer away lap after lap after lap. Now, while he was getting at the front, we did have some good battles going on the track. The Suzuki battle was good. There was a lot of good passing back there. And you can notice this track is very good for passing for motorcycles. Maybe not for F1, but for motorcycles, it's very good because you have connecting corners. You get one corner right, you can run a different line, and it sets you up for the other corner. Vice versa, you can defend into one corner, and it penalizes you out of the other. So that's what makes good passing, if you have some kind of different lines through corners to set you up. So we got to see a lot of that going on. And then by lap 6, though, Fabio, he was starting to pull away, and you saw what this race was going to be doing. And we mentioned Vinales, right? We talked about him. He just wasn't making any ground. Yes, he had a bad qualifying Q1, but I think, you know, we talked about this, and I know we were beating a dead horse, but, you know, like we said, if it's not 100% perfect, Vinales is not going to go fast. And I think now we can say with confidence that that is a concrete answer. There is no changing that. We've seen so many years of his racing where we have these flashes of brilliance, and then we have these flashes of just nothing. And you can't be first and 17th at some point, or first and 12th in the same season, and have that like a regular yo-yo. Like, it just doesn't work that well. And I think we're seeing where he's at now. It almost makes me think he would do better on the Suzuki, just because he loves a good front end, and that's where he's always talking about he loses his feel. on the bike. And honestly, it might be that time where Yamaha's like, you want a better bike and we want a better rider, so maybe we should both switch. I don't know.
No, that's what Quartararo says about the Yamaha. He's fast because he says he can feel the front.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Quartararo loads the front under braking more than Vinales loads the front. And I think that's the key to Quartararo going fast on the Yamaha now. He loads the front on the brakes because he's fairly late on the brakes. Vinales is not known as the late breaker. So he wants to come in with it more gentle, whereas he doesn't have the tire squished like the Michelin wants to be. And so he doesn't know, he can't, it's not all hard braking. Okay, let the tire recover, turn, go to the apex. Like
Jim,
Quartararo kind of does.
Jim, you might be onto something. Think of this. When Vinales was on his game, it's when it was a leftover Lorenzo bike. Now, Lorenzo was not a deep breaker. He got his braking done early, but he was all speed as he carried into the corner, which makes sense for Vinales' riding. Rossi comes from the 990 era. 500s. Well, the 500s, but also the 990 bikes were braking.
Right. It was point squirt.
Yeah, point squirt, where you got it hard on the brakes all the way in. So he's used to that, right? You build that back in. When he comes back, then Vinales is like, this bike doesn't feel good when I brake it. But Quartararo is a very deep braker and like loads, and he loads the front. Like you said, Jim, I think you might be on the right track there.
Yeah, for whatever reason, this weekend, it was very noticeable to see how different Quartararo, that's easy for me to say this late at night, and Vinales were different in what they do. For whatever reason, the camera angles, whatever, it was very obvious to see what they were doing. And I was like thinking, this is it. He's just, it works for Quartararo because he gets in deep, squishes the tire, does all the braking done, fine, tire rebounds as he lets off, as he trails to the corner, turns the gas back on, gone. Vinales tries the same thing. Well, it's just easing. Well, the tire's in that weird phase where it's not squished and it's not upright. And it's like, okay, it's somewhere in the middle. So now it feels all rubbery and squishy and I don't know what to do with the front end and I can't go fast.
Yep. So now at this point of the race, everything kind of settled down. There were some gaps. Quartararo was pulling a gap. Zarco was up there. And Oliveira, who had a great start, was hanging on and just kind of sitting behind Zarco doing his thing. And the Suzukis, who again had a terrible qualifying, they just can't figure out Saturdays, they started making their way towards the front now. And you had Rins lead Mir. The Mir was like, listen, I don't want to be behind you more. He gets around Rins. I'll drag you to the front. They start catching up to everybody. Mir ends up getting past Oliveira first gets past Zarco with 8 to go. And then that's when he got the pressure because he saw Mir was closing down the gap. Mir ends up getting by Zarco. And Rins is like, you know what? I'm going to have some of that too. And then he crashes. And that's 4 DNFs in a row for Rins. Championship is pretty much out the bag. And he may be sending himself out of Suzuki because we've seen too much of this. He has to have a immaculate, squeaky clean rest of the season to appease those bosses, or we may see a seat free up. Now, I'm saying that without looking at contract details, but we all know contracts are there for the looks. They can cancel them and reshape them any way they want at any time. We've seen it time and time again, but Rins has definitely been demoted to, I mean, we knew at the championship last year, right? You still had some room to say, well, if Rins didn't get hurt in the beginning, he might have been the champion too, because he could have gave Rins, you know, or Mir a battle to the end. But we're seeing the gap now, right? We're seeing a guy that can ride on the edge and control it. We're seeing a guy that can get to the edge but can't control it. And that's not going to fly at the top brass, because if anything, you can't win. You bring home the points. And if you're not bringing home the points, they've had so many chances to be that number two team out there right now in the championship, and they're just giving it away. That's not going to look good. But a little bit longer of the race there. We got 3 to go. Nakagami crashes out and just has another, you know, poor ending to – it wasn't a great race, but he was making time up. He was getting comfortable with the bike, but he pushed just a little bit past his limit at that time. And we get to the end of the race. And Quartararo, who had been out front, he's just a strong showing again. And honestly – if you had to look back the season, if it wasn't for the arm pump and it wasn't for the rain, this might be four races in a row. Quartararo is very much looking like the guy to beat this year. And it looks a little different than when he did the double Jerez last year that had his fade off, because he's looking aggressive, but he's looking like he's learned, right?
Because yeah, it's controlled aggression. He's learned how to control his aggression to get the maximum out of the bike required for him to win. And he's realizing that winning is fine if you win by 10 seconds, 1 second, or 1/10 of a second. That's still 25 points.
And you know what I like? He's been able to bounce back this year. Last year, yes. I think he couldn't bounce back. He fell into a hole, and he just could not see his way. This time, it's like, oh, my arms are killing me. How am I getting a recovery with this? I'll go grab pole, then, you know, I'll have a decent race. Oh, it rains. Okay. Rain is not my thing. I'll race. Okay, I'll get some good points, and I'll leave here. All right. You know, didn't have a great weekend. I'm struggling in practice. Okay, I'll go get pole again. All right. You know, all the Ducati got in front of me. Oh, he crashed out. Cool. I'll go take the win. It's like, that's a strong showing. And if it hadn't been for one or two other races, we might be looking at a big gulf in the championship. But luckily, we're not so much. So we end up getting Fabio Quartararo. He gets it getting Miguel Oliveira with a strong showing in the KTM, getting their first podium of the season and showing that those updates may definitely be working better for the bike. He gets second. Joan Mir ends up clawing his way back into third in front of a fading Johan Zarco in fourth. Brad Binder, another strong showing by the KTM with a nice top five finish. He finishes in front of Jack Miller after they ran around together for quite some time on the track. Aleix Espargaró, who had a great qualifying position, did end up fading back to 7th. Jim thinks the bike is there for the podium. I still think it's exactly where it belongs there in 7th. It's not quite there yet. Marek Vinales finishes in 8th. He did bring himself up towards the end, but he finishes some 17 seconds back of his teammate, and that ain't going to fly for him. Petrucci had a very nice race, finishing in 9th. It's actually two good races for him. He finished in front of his Italian compatriot Valentino Rossi, who did get a top 10 for this season, even though he did have a few people fall down in front of him to get there, 4. But regardless, he stayed on the bike. Not the race that he wanted, but for sure the race that was given to him. Igalik won it there in 11th. Paul Espargaró, Pirro, Alex Marquez, Salvadori. Morbidelli ended up not finishing last after being in DFL for a while after running off the prep. He finished in front of Luca Marini. And that brings us to our championship. Now, our championship here, we got Fabio Quartararo on 105 points. Zarco, so those two flying Frenchmen. No one ever gets sick of saying that. You won't hear it 20 more times this season. He's on 81 points. Pecco Bagnaia now slips to third on 79. Miller there in fourth on 74. Joan Mir finishing out the top five at 65. Actually, we'll bring it down one more position because it's still close with him. Matt Vinales in sixth. Then you kind of jump back a little bit. But the second place right now is a very hotly contested position. Quartararo, if he gets on a run and connects these next few races, it's going to look scary for the season, Jim.
Yep. One, Quartararo has put a finger on the trophy. Yeah. Right?
One finger. Small finger. One finger.
He's got a finger on it, right? Yeah, I'm not saying he's got a grasp. He's not saying he has a finger definitely on it. It's looking good. It's going the right way. Let's talk a little bit about what happened after the race with Oliveira and Mir, because I got to rant about this one.
Okay. Now, yeah, because it's on here too, so let's do it. That was my point to talk about this, let's get to it.
So at the end of the race, we see that, hey, we're told by race direction, Oliveira track limits on the last lap, therefore you must drop one place. Shit. Oliveira is now third. Mir goes to second. Okay, well, all right, fine. Show me what he did wrong. Well, what'd he do? He's coming out of, I forget what turn it was. And literally all he does is he just misses the paint, the green paint, literally by like what? 6 millimeters at the most. Like, are you guys kidding me? Because, okay, no spoiler alert. This shit had been happening all race weekend. all Sunday. People were being docked positions on the final lap for exceeding track limits. I'm like, oh my gosh, you gotta be kidding me. And then I'm like, the next thing I know, they come out with, oh, by the way, Juan Mir had track limits warning on the last lap as well. And guess what? He's now committed the crime. So he falls back a place. So he's now third and Oliveira's now second. We're back to normal again. And I'm going, well, duh, he was falling right behind him. How could he have not done the same thing? I'm like, okay. So we suddenly now have found out that basically track limits are literally now etched in stone somewhere, and we're going to penalize everybody for millimeters off of this. I'm like, okay, we're going to do that penalty, but yet we're not going to penalize the guys in we're not going to penalize anybody for crossing over onto the paint, exiting out of the pit lane at Mugello to straighten the corner out so they can go faster in a straight line. We're all talking about how much we don't like MotoGP bikes almost getting airborne, going over the hump into the first turn, yet you're letting them go someplace that they can keep accelerating through that portion of the track instead of having to maybe roll out or crack the throttle if they were held to the actual racing track itself. And then you got Moto3 guys that were in the grass before at the end of the pit lane who get no penalty whatsoever. But I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I get it. There is a limit to the tracks, and I know that. But this, the way that we are applying this letter of the law is going to ruin racing. How would you like to have your world championship docked on you at the end of the year because you were 2 millimeters over a line when you're riding your balls off after 45 minutes? I'd be hot. I would be hacked. So they've got, I mean, Ben Spies is on Twitter and he's like, when are we going to get rid of this ridiculousness of track limits? I'm like, see, he's like, let's start a petition. I'll sign it because I thought that was just brutal. It was brutal to Joe Roberts in Moto2. It was brutal to Oliveira. I mean, again, they righted it and they made it right, but still, ugh, this is ridiculous. I mean, I want to fix track limits, but I mean, I would have been like, hey, if you touch the grass at that point, I could see it. I could go with you. I could say, yep, you were out of bounds. You were not on any asphalt. We're talking about a little area that's maybe 6 inches to 8 inches wide. That's green paint next to grass and a white line. And you're coming off the arc of the corner anyway. I just don't get it, Skyler. What am I missing in this? Because I'm telling you, this was total crap.
You're not missing anything, Jim, because it's total bullshit with where it's enforced. And that's the problem. You're going to go out there and you're going to take a turn that didn't have track limits, right? And now you're going to put down some green paint on the exit of that corner. That doesn't mean the track ends there. That's just where you decided that's where bikes shouldn't be. And the real bad part about the corner that they nicked them in, and it was the same place they got Roberts. And we're not just saying this because Roberts there or this track. This has been ongoing on. This happened, who got snipped at the Austrian race last year?
Jorge Martin in Moto2.
Thank you. Right, where it's like,
because I was ready to rant that one too.
Yeah, and it's like you're just on the edge, and it's not where the track ends; it's where they decided it ends. Right, they could put this back another foot if they want. It's ridiculous, and this particular point in the track is between two corners where they have no reason to swoop back in. It's a right-hander with another right-hander. You stay wide, and the thing is, it's only separated by about, I don't know, 20 yards between the two apexes of these corners, or whatever it is on the outside, not the apex, on the outside of the exit and the entry to the next corner, about 20 yards apart. And it literally, the green paint ends and the track scoots over 2 inches, and then it goes back out. And then the thing is, you can run on the outside of the track into the corner, and then you're going, like you said, you're going to enforce that track limit, but you can have 12 Moto3 bikes headed down the front straight, and they can run all the way out into pit lane to draft and pass each other and cross the lines. That shit's way more dangerous. Like, if you want to stop that, the worst track, put some soft cones up or something. Like, you're kidding me. That is definitely taking advantage because you're running out beyond track limits at that point, whereas somebody who, you know, outside of a corner, and both of them ran, it was like 2 inches, and you're deciding a race off of this is complete crap. And this green paint needs to go. If you really want to have a track limit, you tell the track next year, just go ahead and delete that part of the asphalt. Because guess what? Grass is a penalty in itself. You run in the grass, then that's your risk. You drop a front tire, you're going to crash. You put your rear tire, you spin up, you lose momentum going to the next corner. I don't see how we can continue having this ridiculous chat about these track limits. It's going to keep happening. We're going to have a great result. And when it happens to their favorites, when it happens to the money makers, when it decides a race that really matters, that's when it's going to be finally taken out.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. I it was frustrating to me because it was every class. It was every class had somebody drop in a position. And I will give MotoGP this credit. They developed a system that uses sensors that decide whether the bike is in or out. So there is no gray area like Formula One. Oh, is it two tires? Is it two tires completely? Or is it okay if it's one tire and 3/4 of the rear tire is on the white line, but the 1/4 of it's over the line? Is that in? Is that out? There's no gray with their system. It's in and it's out. I thank you for that, MotoGP. You get a 10 out of 10 for that. But where you decide to place the, I'm assuming there's a sensor in the track that has to match to a sensor in the bike. But where you place that sensor on the, out of that curve, take the last sensor out of it, because then we'd have great racing. Because nobody was gaining anything at that point. And it's just, it's mind-numbing. I'm done. We get more stuff to cover.
Yeah, we're almost at an hour. We haven't even got to the races.
That's how we go sometimes.
All right, so we'll have to shorten up
We'll shorten it up here.
Yeah, we'll have to skip all through. Moto2 qualifying. You want to just hit that real quick?
Yeah, I'll hit it real quick, and I'll let you do the race. So Moto2 qualifying, basically nothing really happens in the first qualifying session. You're hoping that Cam is going to get out of it, but he doesn't. So basically you had Chara, Ramirez, Bender, or Bo Benschneider, and go through. Then the Q2, it was always going to be Lowe's versus Gardner for it. It always was. I mean, halfway through it was Lowe's, it was Gardner, Vierge, Bezzecchi, Raul, and Arbolino. Kinect crashed. And then we had the third sector, Lowe's was slow. There was raindrops that were coming down, and not because at this point of the day, it was like, was it going to rain? Was it not going to rain? But it all depended on who was going to actually get there at the end and who was at the right point for when the rain was coming down or not coming down. So, basically it was, Raul Fernandez taking the pole position. Lowe's was second. Then Navarro snuck in to put Remy back on the second row. Then DG Antonio, Tony Arbolino, Bezzecchi, Vierge, Schroeder. Joe Roberts qualified in 10th. And then Della Porta, Agüero, Fernandez, Ramirez, Adliger, who is the 16-year-old Spanish wonder. I got to work on Aldiger. Aldiger is how you say it. Sorry, I wrote it down. All right. And then Bobin Schneider, Canet, and Chantra. So that's your qualifying. Again, you're on the first couple rows in Moto 2. You're going to be doing just fine.
That's right. So we'll bliss on through this race. We get to Moto 2 race. We had Gardner with the great hole shot there with his teammate. And Raul Fernandez was up there with him. Bezzecchi, though, he spun the hell out of the wheel off the line. It was weird. It was almost like he was like lighting it up like.
Intentionally.
It was a Fast and the Furious movie, and he was spinning his tire hoping to get traction on the whole shot or something. It was really weird, but he ended up losing quite a bit of space. There was talk that maybe he might be penalized for it, but I think he penalized himself enough after the start of the race. He didn't get out of his box. He just spun his tire.
He got style points for me, though.
Yeah, no, it was nice. Lorenzo Della Porta, he ended up having a crash. He ended up, his bike was humping in the first corner. It had contact with Chantra as everyone kind of squeezed down. He got up mad, but honestly, dude, it was a racing incident. No harm, no foul. Augusto Fernandez, he ended up crashing at turn 10 early on. Baldassare was soon to follow with a crash at 13 on lap 4. And then by that time, Fernandez, he was starting to stretch the field. It was looking like it was his race to lose. He had gotten up front. Nobody was challenging. He was starting to drop Sam Lowe's. He was starting to drop his teammate Gardner, who started the race with him, but it was stretching out quite quickly. Jorge Navarro, you've heard this before, crashes out in turn 1 on lap 5, followed by Xavi Verhey, who ended up crashing out in turn 12 on lap 6, which is a bit of a crash fest at the beginning of the race. Now, as we started going through the race, this is where it started to get a bit stretched out, and we were kind of wondering, I don't think this is going to be a good race, Jim. It's getting stretched out. It's too bad. Moto 2, we kind of got spoiled this year, but this is probably the race where it's going to look like an old Moto 2 race. And then it was even heightened for it because Sam Lowe's, he ended up getting by Remy Gardner, and I put Kenny Chase him down, and Sam was looking really, really good. And then we saw that, you know, okay, maybe he can make a race of it. Maybe he can run him down. We're like, okay, cool, it's back on. And we saw Albert Reynes, he ended up crashing out. He's not having a great rookie season. He's kind of learning his place. I think a lot of the rookies are. Fabio DiGiantono, this is a bad one, man. He ended up crashing out of fourth place on turn 15 with 10 laps to go. So there's definitely some attrition in Moto2 in this race. Now, we really started to get exciting at this point because we're down less than 10 laps to go. Lowe's was taking chunks out of Fernandez. He was taking a quarter of a second out of him, lap after lap. He ended up getting the gap down under a second. He was closing quick. In the back behind, a little bit there, the Roberts ended up taking over fourth place. He was having a nice battle with Bezzecchi for fourth with 7 to go. And then we saw the race come. We thought it was going to be a great race and battle because it was Sam Lowe's. He was dragging Gardner with him. And then Sam Lowe's crashed with only 6 laps to go. And has definitely put a hurt on his championship. And Jim, you had mentioned it a couple weeks ago, and I'm afraid you might be right. Crashing Sam Lowe's might be back.
I think crashing Sam Lowe's is back, to be honest. That's, you know, he's had that one problem, not to his own fault. I think he started to try to ride harder to make up for the problem that he had. But the problem with that is that you have this kid named Raul Fernandez, who's really looking good, and he's there at the front the whole time, and here is Lowe's trying to kind of keep up, and he's asking a little bit too much of it. And I really hate to see that from Sam. He needs to take good thing is he goes to Barcelona next weekend right away. Lowe's kind of gels with that track. Hopefully he'll be able to do something this time, but Lowe's has to keep it on 2 wheels next weekend. Absolutely positively. Otherwise, his championship is going to take a massive hit that he's not going to be able to recover from.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, at this point, we end up having Bezzecchi. I think he kind of got woken up. Now, Bezzecchi was with the top runners. He had gotten started to slip back. Roberts got around him. And Roberts at the time was running 0.6 a second a lap faster than Bezzecchi. So he thought he was going to gap, but Bezzecchi stuck it behind him. And they started having a battle where they were going back and forth. We lost Marcos Ramirez. He ended up having a crash with 3 to go. And then it was back. Roberts now grabbed the pole or third position back from Bezzecchi with 2 to go. So that was a great race. But as we were watching that race, we realized that, wait a minute, Gardner was all over the back of Raul Fernandez. Now, he ran his teammate down. We thought maybe he was just following Sam, and once Sam crashed, that was going to be it. But no, he figured out what he needed to do. And on the final lap, Remy actually ended up getting by Raul Fernandez. And it was a great timed move because he got by him just in time. He was able to punish him where he was stronger, and he ends up taking his first Moto2 win of the season. I think it might be his first Moto2 win, actually, altogether. But gets the win, and a brilliant right there, and finishes in front of his teammate. And it was a great race at the end. I didn't expect that race at the end, Jim. I really thought this was going to be one of those ones where we watched the paint dry, and it was like, okay, that was great. It's over. But we ended up getting a nice little battle there at the end.
Yeah, partially due to, I believe, Raul suffering arm pump. I remember them talking about that, and I'm like, oh, I'm wondering if he's going to go underneath the knife and get arm pump surgery here. Because if he's pumping up, that's why he had that big lead. And where were we before Le Mans? Where were we at? Portimao? Can't remember. Or Jerez? Either, it might have been Jerez, right? And so he won there. But that's what they're talking about. I expect him to go to arm pump surgery here after Barcelona, probably, because there's a weekend off in between so he could recover. It was a good race. Remy rode a good race. He definitely spends more time on used tires, and that bike looks better under him on used tires than it does on anybody else. And that's what you need to win races at the end. And I was getting sort of afraid that Remy was going to not be able to stem the tide that is Raul Fernandez, but I think they're equal, at least for right now. Probably just pure determination and grit gives Remy the title, but Fernandez is probably the more naturally gifted rider. But I am going to be interested to see. I don't think it's going to be Quartararo-esque, but I do think Gardner will do better on the bigger bike. I just think that he will. Just his frame, his size, kind of how he rides, I think fits a MotoGP bike better than the Moto2 bike. But
just like I feel like Darren Binder, we've talked about Darren Binder, he's going to be great on a Moto2 bike. He's just too big for the Moto3.
Yes.
Now,
same thing.
Yeah, and we get back to track. You know, Joe Roberts, he finishes third, but is doing Moto1 place for the track limits. Again, you know, we're not going to get back on that before we discuss that. Cam Bobier, got to figure out Saturday. This is three races in a row. He's qualified in the 20-somethings and ran it back to the front. Now, he has crashed out of those 6th and 9th positions he had. But this was a great showing for Cam because he got his top 10 by getting in 8th place. But he did it in Moto2 fashion. He got in the group. He mixed it up. And right at the end, he got enough strategy to get himself right at the draft coming out of the last corner. And ended up motoring the guy to the line. And he got 8th place by the narrowest of margins.
Yep, it's very close.
Yeah,
he did it by twenty four hundredths of a of a second. I mean, mm-hmm. that's not much.
No,
Cam is coming good, right? I think he's starting to understand what it takes. Got to get a little better on Saturday. If we could get Cam out of the first session into the second session and be starting in the top 10, I think he's going to finish, you know, top six, top maybe top five, and that'll be good for him.
Yeah, because
it'd be good to have both Americans up there.
Right. If you look at the final results, right, and that's going to be Gardner, Fernandez, Bezecchi, and then Roberts, right? Now let's look at mm-hmm. the guys behind that. Schroeder, Cam is finished in front of him. Agüero, Cam is finished in front of Arbolino, he's finished in front of. So these are all guys he could finish with or in front of, right? So he's raced with everybody that's been outside of those top four guys. He could definitely start making his way and maybe, just maybe, sneak a top five finish in this year, which would be great for him.
Yep. Yeah, I think it would be. If he could get to top five, that'd be a great season for him. We'll build on it and go to next year.
That's right. All right, so everybody
said the championship.
Yeah, yeah, go for it. Go for it.
All right, so Gardner leads on 114 points. Fernandez is second on 108. So that gives us a 6-point difference. That is nothing in here.
Nope.
They have a bit of a gap on Bezecchi because Bezecchi is 20 points behind. Then Lowe's is now on 66. So he's 22 points beyond Bezecchi. Lowe's has got to finish next weekend. He has to. Then it's Gigi Antonio, Joe Roberts, Schroeder, Agüero, who's the best rookie in the class, then Kinnett and Arbolino. Although I must admit, Arbolino is looking much better. They found something in the wet at Le Mans, and he's carried it over. Arbolino is getting better. I pick Arbolino for a podium at some point this year. Not Ooh. Sure where or when, but look for Arbolino to be on a podium.
All right. Okay. Well, that's a great call. We'll see. So you got Arbolino, podium. I've got Cam in the top five. Okay.
Yep.
Let's see if we're right or wrong. Right All or right. wrong in this season. All right. So that gets us on over to Moto3. Jim, why don't you run us through qualifying and the race?
Okay. So with the Moto3 qualifying, in the first qualifying session, it was Suzuki, Pedro Acosta. We're beginning to figure out that Acosta really can't qualify, which is sort of sad. You know, it doesn't matter, right? But he's been in the second, in the first session more times than not. Then Tatai, Toba, and Artigas are all there. They had 12 minutes and 43 seconds left in the first session before all the bikes decided to leave. Everybody just sat around waiting to go out. Again, this mismanagement of time and all the other stuff that's all there. But then, you know, they kind of got down to it to where Suzuki, Toba, Pedro, Acosta, and Antonelli all get through and go into that second session. Now, the second session, again, we had waiting. Everybody's waiting. Pedro Acosta is the first guy to go out. And then, you know, I thought, okay, they were all waiting for this championship leader to follow the kid, right? Nope. They just kept on waiting again. And it's like, okay, when is anybody going to go out? Well, there was maybe only like 11 minutes or something left when everybody started to go out. But Suzuki went to the pole. And then we had, at the very end, we have the problem with Pasquier and Sasaki. They're down. You know, we talked about it. I don't think there's nothing more to say about that. And we can get to the race. Now, in the race, it's Mugello. It's the draft. I don't know how in the world you'd actually – I feel for Dylan Gray and Matt Bird trying to call that race because it's almost terrible. But I thought maybe we'd take a little different spin. Maybe we'll talk about it from a strategy standpoint of what was going on. It was obvious that you had to be in the lead draft. You needed to stay in the lead draft to actually have any chance of this. But the problem was that you had everybody going into turn one, and it would be like, oh, okay. It was anybody who was eighth was suddenly first going into the first turn, and then everybody else sorted themselves out back again. And it was like instant replay with the same thing on the next lap, and you're kind of watching the same thing. You just started mixing the players in and out of that situation. Ideally, though, there was consistent about who was there. It was all the people that you expected to be. It's some order of Foggia, Fanati, Rodrigo, Acosta, Bender, Nepa, Suzuki, Alcoba, Sasaki, and Philip Slatch. They're the guys that are in this 15 rider lead gap, and it comes down to you've got to figure out where you can be and not get passed before you get to the start finish line. So it's a high-speed chess game that these guys are all playing, and it was trying to figure out who was going to get their sums correct or not correct in it. there were interesting things that happened. Anchi went down early on. His bike ghosted down to the next turn, sort of like Austria from a couple years ago. But that was really sort of like the one major incident. But again, we saw Acosta. His strategy was like, well, I'm going to go to the front each time, thinking maybe he could break away in a twistier section. That was a bad strategy because every time he got to the front, everybody else just drafting him back again on the main straightaway. McPhee had a really interesting strategy because he stayed back really far. He had a good qualifying, but he was back, and he was never the guy that was going really deep into the first turn. He was the guy who was a little earlier on the brakes, and he was always the guy coming out in the fourth, fifth, sixth. So McPhee looked like he maybe had a shot at this one. It's really interesting how these guys think, because you have to be thinking about everything that you're doing on the bike, watching your pit board, all those other things, and then figure out where you want to be. Can I be drafted? Can I not be drafted? I really thought Acosta was going to go to the front on the last lap and then use his speed, because he was very quick through the last turn, to pull a little bit of a gap that nobody could draft him back by. But that went out the window because with like three laps to go, he had drafted back to the front. And Fanati was there and everybody. So they all sort of shuffled him back. So in the next to last lap, he went from leading to 11th place in that thing, which left him a ton of work to do to try to pass, 10 guys to get back to the front. So his part was pretty much there. The man who became impressive was the fact that the guy that nobody was talking about, or we didn't see very much of, was Foggia. And suddenly Foggia had got himself to the front. And we know that the Leopard Hondas are definitely fast in a straight line. And so he took that to heart. He was the guy who was able to be the latest on the brakes the first turn, ran a strategy that got him to the front at that point, was able to then maintain it and use the Honda horsepower to lead himself to the line. However, it was one of those things where as soon as Foggia had done that and kind of got a little bit of a gap through Casanova, Savelli on the backside, that everything went crazy, because the people then who were behind in the second and third, they tried to figure out what to do, so they started racing themselves. So Masia, Rodrigo, Sasaki were all starting to change places, which that's not how you're going to run down Foggia on that run to the line. You needed to just kind of stay cool, and then you could have all just kind of blown past him and pushed him there. So as it turns out, when we get to the end of it, Foggia wins the race on, again, a brilliant strategy. Then Masia finishes second, Rodrigo, Sasaki, Bender was there. You know, the king of the late breakers couldn't make anything work, because essentially by the time he gets done doing all the braking, there's no momentum to get going again. And Fanati was sixth. McPhee couldn't make it work with his Honda. You know, again, caught out on the wrong side of things. I think he was bumped a little bit going in. There was a nudge as they were going in there. And then you had Acosta, who had to drop a place because he had exceeded track limits. And Garcia also had to drop a place. And that put him into ninth, right behind Acosta. Then Suzuki, then Salak, Toba, Antonelli, Nepa, and Alcoba. It's a brilliant race to watch. If you have the means to go back and watch it, please do. It's a lot of stuff going around and a lot of shuffling. Hopefully there's a little insight into kind of what I thought people were trying to do. You have anything, Skylar, you want to add to that?
I mean, I have, I think, about six notes here when I was watching it. So this is how my notes go. So I was a little proud of myself on this one, because I said, okay, Acosta got the hole shot. Great. I was like, Chanachu crashes. So I was like, oh, okay. There was another incident right behind us. A little bit of a scary incident right there at the very beginning of the race. And luckily they were towards the middle back, because the bike can't down the hill and back on the track, but the group had already gotten by. So, okay. And then I put Moto3's draft fest, as we expected. It's a top 5 15 group, and here's what I put. I'm like, but Foggia's bike looks the fastest, because could be a threat at the end.
Good call. So, I did not see Foggia being a force in this race.
Mm-hmm.
I should have, but I really thought of all the KTMs out front, they would have worked together to get there. Well, him at bay.
The only reason I said Foggia's bike looks fast, because he really hasn't been there for much of this year, and that bike is so bright blue, it stands out, especially with all that KTM red or orange and blue up there, right? I was like, oh. And I noticed, I was like, he doesn't always have to be like right in the biggest draft. He just needs a little bit of a draft. And I was like, that's interesting. Now, again, like you said, strategy wise, he got the best thing that could happen. He hit the front, put a small gap in, but then second, third started dicking around, and that's what really won him that race. But yeah, great race. Yeah. Moto 3 this year, as any year, it's hard to take notes. You just have to watch it because there's 15 or 16 changes for the lead in the first five laps. It's hard to tell. But more importantly, it's just so exciting. You just don't want to look away from the screen. It's so mm-hmm. good. The racing goes from the beginning of the race to the end of the race. It is mayhem. It's definitely the series. If you are trying to get someone to watch motorcycle racing, have them watch that series because it's the easiest. They're a little bit slower. They're all together, and the bikes are really fun.
Yep. Agreed. Definitely there. With that, Acosta still leads the points. He's on 111. His nearest competitor is Masi on 59. So he's definitely extending the points lead again. Mm-hmm. Then it's Sasaki. Notice the theme there? KTM, KTM, KTM. Mm-hmm. Then Garcia on a gas, KTM. Mm-hmm. And then Fanati on a KTM, Husqvarna. And then Bender is the first Honda. Bender's the first Honda. Then you have Minho, Antonelli, Foggia, and Rodrigo. If I said that Quartararo had a finger on the championship, Acosta has at least a grip on it.
Yeah.
The interesting thing now is that what does this kid do? The kid's brilliant. There's no way around it. You had the rain in Le Mans, which is then that track is weird with the surface, the wind, all the right handers before you have to make the first left, and that's a weird off camber turn anyway. So that track, I hate the term outlier, but it's definitely a different beast than anybody else. You've got him racing on tracks where a lot of experience is required in Moto 3 to know when to draft by, when not to draft by, when to roll out of it a little bit. You know, that's the things you got to learn that he hasn't really learned because he hasn't really raced in a pack yet. Yes, he's raced in smaller packs with only two or three guys, but he hasn't really ran in packs that are 15, 20 guys. And it's a different feel about how you got to go about that and figure your way out. If the kid wins the championship, there's no reason for him to be in Moto 3 again next year. He needs to be on a Moto 2 bike. And, well, there's a space at IO, right? Because we know Remy's gone. Mm-hmm. I'm positive Acosta, win or lose the title, is going to that IO seat mm-hmm. next year. Mm-hmm. Guaranteed, going to happen. And he'll spend a couple of years in Moto 2. Fine-tuning his craft, mm-hmm. and we'll see what he does on a bigger bike. He's ridden 600s before, so it shouldn't be too much of a change for him. But the one thing about it, and you're talking about strategy, is Acosta has so much belief in the front end of that bike that he can drive to the apex and have enough feel to be able to stop there and still hold a very tight line where everybody else is not able to do that. So he's able to get in, essentially get to the apex before everybody else by using this, what I would call a very inside-ish line compared to everybody else. And then since he's at that point, he now occupies the space that everybody else wants to get to. He forces them to roll out or check up ever so slightly and is able to get back out of the corner in the lead. Watch for that when we're at Barcelona because there's several corners that will play to his style of riding in that way. So we'll see what happens when we get there. Ooh. So with that, I guess we're going to wrap up the show, right, Skylar?
That's right. We need to get the heck out of here.
Yeah. So there's one thing. I found on NBC Sports, they have a YouTube video of how MotoGP launch control systems work. It's actually they talked to one of the guys at Gresini team with the Aprilia. We will put a link to that video in the show notes. I hope our friends in Europe will be able to see it. I don't know if it's a regional thing because it was on MSNBC or not MSNBC, NBC Sports here in the U.S. And I'll try to be sure that I throw it out on my Twitter account as well. So where can people find you, Skylar?
You can find me at that point on Twitter and Instagram, sometimes lurking around there, at SkylarV28. Where can they find you, Jim?
We'll be at MotoRGV on Instagram and Twitter, and I'll make sure to put the link, at least in my Twitter account. We'll try to put it in the show notes. It is a pretty fascinating thing on how it works, and they go through it. So I want to be sure that you guys have access to it.
Excellent. All right. And don't forget, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We have our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. And like you said, we're on Twitter there at @moto_pod. You can follow us there for any news, announcements, or general motorcycle banter. We have another race coming up this weekend. We're at Barcelona, so make sure you tune in, and we'll be back next week for another show. And I'm pretty sure we should get this one out. Last week we had so many technical issues, fire alarms, everything else. It took a while to get that all patched together, but this is a very straightforward show. So I suspect probably maybe later tonight, Jim.
Ooh, awesome. I'll be sure I email you that link.
There you go.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you after Barcelona.
Zoom, zoom.